You are listening to the Battle Born Libertarian Podcast, the official podcast of the Libertarian Party of Nevada. Here's your host, Tyus France.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for tuning into the Battle Born Libertarian Podcast, the official podcast of the Libertarian Party of Nevada. It's been almost a month since I have recorded one of these episodes, and today I'm going to be recording a bunch more because I'm going to be tearing down this studio. So this might be, well, it won't be the last episode you see with this beautiful backdrop here, but it will be the last day that I'll be recording in this exact situation. So every time you see this same setup, then you know it's been recorded on the same day. If you're listening via audio, then you can disregard all of that I just said about the location. In studio with me, I don't have Alex here. He's going to be here a little later today. But sitting across from me, I have my very good friend, Jason. Thank you for being here.
Hey, Tyus. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So, Jason and I get into regular debates, I would say almost daily when we see each other. And I wouldn't say they're debates. Discussions. About all kinds of things that I would classify as libertarian or freedom or liberty-minded. Would you agree?
Yeah, I agree. And I think we have similar philosophies, but are just different enough that we can have a lot of really good discussion as far as where we are on a spectrum, to the extent there is a spectrum of libertarianism and liberty.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I consider myself a bit of an anarchist, and I think you'd be more like a minarchist realm within that. Like,
well, compared to you, yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, compared to you, I'm a big statist.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. So where did you start on that journey, and then where are you now? So, you know, a lot of people, they're brought up and they take the views of their family members, and then they often will get to their own place. That journey is unique. What was yours like?
So my journey was really just sort of an enlightenment in education. So I learned a lot of economics in school, in college, and took a lot of that. And I mean, also I learned it growing up. I learned a lot about finance and economics, and that got me to the point of where I am now, which is really to have a lot more freedoms and free market, and, you know, from the financial side. And then socially, I just, you know, have a personal belief in people should be able to do what they want to do as long as they're not hurting others, which, you know, I think just comes from, you know, the way I was raised. You know, my parents weren't really into politics or anything along those lines. It's just sort of what I kind of came to know from reading a lot and you know, sort of being informed the way the world worked.
What do you think was the economics primarily that got you there, or was it? Because I know for me, like, the economics changed my game completely, and I didn't even think that economics would be a real thought in my political views. But then there's also kind of the economics covers almost the logic side of things, but often negates the emotional side. If that makes sense.
Yeah. So, you know, for better or for worse, I'm not a very emotional person, so I have, you know, I can use my logic and not be swayed by emotions in theory, right? And there's some extent where I am, right? When I had my first daughter and she was in the hospital for 3 months, I got emotional, and it really threw me off my game.
Oh, really?
I was like, oh, what are these things coming out of my eyes? What's this liquid coming out of my eye? I don't know what this means, you know? But yeah, it came from logic and understanding of sort of what I consider, you know, basic economics, right?
Cool. So we have a bunch of discussions that we get to all the time, but your career has been that of in the legal system, right?
Yes. So I was an attorney for 15 years. I still am an attorney, licensed in California, not in Nevada. And I did business and intellectual property law, were what I specialized in. And sort of my subspecialty was in internet and cyberspace related law, which is really interesting, especially related to, you know, the way that, you know, when it comes to liberty and things like that, because a lot of things a lot of matters online, the law was always catching up to the technology. So there was always what I call sort of code-based regulation, which is sort of a misnomer for code, because it's not your typical code, like a state statute code, but code as in people writing software code. And the way that businesses worked in a free market state, they did what made the most sense for them for coding in a software code way, and they call that sort of code-based regulation, different from a sort of state-based regulation, where a lot of matters online ended up being code-based in that it was free market software coders that were really, I don't want to say creating the law, but creating the landscape of the way that business worked.
So what are the, I'm sure that you see patterns along that journey of going into these different cases and stuff. What are kind of the primary intellectual property things that continually come up?
Well, it's interesting because intellectual property in the last 25 years, 20 years since the internet has really boomed and become sort of mainstream, has taken on such a different aspect, right? So you look at, you know, I call pre-internet days, so talking 80s and before, which, you know, technically the internet existed, but it wasn't a commercially viable entity that people, you know, regularly used. So before that, you know, physical assets, hard assets meant a whole lot more. Whereas now, intellectual property means a lot more because it's just, it's so much easier to move and it's so much easier to distribute the property. And it can be distributed without significant cost, right? So if, you know, you compare physical property to intellectual property, and if you have one tractor, which is physical property, it can only plow so many, you know, meters or feet of sand every day or whatever it is it's actually doing, right? Whereas this podcast, for example, is a piece of intellectual property. We can have one person listening to it. We could have 50 people listening to it. We could have 50,000 people listening to it. We have 50 million people listening to it. We could have 5 billion people listening to it. We could have the whole world listening to it. And the really interesting thing about that is the cost for distribution is almost zero. So, you know, the difference between having 50,000 people listening to it versus 50 million people listening to it is basically zero, at least from, you know, from your standpoint.
This, I mean, podcasts right now, one of the reasons I'm really interested in them is that it's one of the most free forms of distribution available right now. There's no regulations on them, at least none that I know of. I could be wrong about that, but I don't know if, like, the FCC isn't telling me what I can or can't do.
Well, you still have regulations in that, you know, you're not allowed to defame people. You know, that's those sort of matters. So there's still some regulation,
sure,
but just that's no different than anything you do in regular life. But there's no additional regulations the way there would be over, like, over-the-air broadcast television or radio or something like that.
Well, you brought up something really interesting as far as, like, a tractor versus a digital good. And it was something that a book, The Libertarian Critique of Intellectual Property, written by a guy named Butler Schaefer. So I read this book and really opened my eyes to a different way of thinking about value. And basically the difference was, he argued that a lot of people think that creation is what gives somebody ownership of something and gives something value. So if I create something, if I create a sandwich, then I've put the work in and I'm into the thing that has value, so that value belongs to me. His argument, though, is that value comes from scarcity, and so if there's something that if there's only that one sandwich, suddenly that sandwich is really, really valuable. But if this podcast can go out to everybody in the world for no distribution cost, maybe there shouldn't be a price tag on it because there's no scarcity to that. And this is a conflict that I've had a hard time getting my head around, specifically because you brought up the thing about pharmaceutical drugs one time.
Yeah.
Would you give us that argument?
Sure. So, you know, when someone says to me, you know, well, intellectual property shouldn't really exist, and they go use a sort of scarcity argument, and they don't look at creation as what should really mean ownership, right? They want, like, a free society where everything is just a free good that anyone can have access to. There's a few things. One is, if they do that, they're free about the tragedy of the commons and the issues they have there with tangible goods and tangible assets that have a certain lifespan and certain, you know, can only be consumed a certain, you know, a finite amount, right? So, but then we look at digital goods where they could be consumed infinitely with minimal or no cost. And a lot of times I've seen that argument saying, well, this is why IP is bad, especially in digital goods and places where there's no, you know, there's no scarcity and it could be consumed infinitely. Now, what I like to say is, you know, you need to incentivize people to do the creation, right? So I think that's where intellectual property, and, you know, it's interesting because as someone who considers themselves, you know, into liberty and freedom, I don't really like the constraints, but at the same time, I want to see things happen and I want to, you know, give incentives to creation, which I understand, you know, economically as self-interested actors, people aren't going to want to invest in creation if they can't own something and, you know, get some sort of benefit out of it. I mean, they might do a little bit, but it would be less so than if they could also benefit from it as well, right? So, And the amount of that I can't really quantify, but I think it's pretty safe to say that, you know, if somebody is getting paid something for something, they'd be more willing to do it than if they weren't getting paid to do it. And I think most libertarians would agree with me on that.
I mean, but is the solution, though, rather than to incentivize the or to say that the creation is where the value lies, is there some responsibility to the creator to protect his own information?
Sure. So that's what I was getting with. You know, I was laying the foundation earlier for my argument regarding the value of IP, and the example I gave you when you said, no, I don't really like IP. It was, well, what about, you know, you have to incentivize these people, the creators, inventors, to invent and create. And I said, what about the example of pharmaceuticals? People spend millions and millions and millions of dollars in order to, in research and development. And the reason they're doing that is because they know, well, and you know, these are the big companies that are doing this. They know that if they do hit gold, so to say, or they do hit, you know, a successful,
they create the Viagra.
They create the Viagra. They hit whatever. They're gonna get paid for it, right? So, and look, for every Viagra, there's probably 10 other drugs there that don't work that spent millions and millions, tens of millions of dollars, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars in research and development that didn't work out. But they do that just in order to because they think they'll be able to get paid later on for that investment. So, if we didn't incentivize them by giving them, you know, a patent, which is, you know, 20 years of exclusive rights, at least in the U.S. it is. Well, it depends on the type of patent. Generally, 20 years exclusive rights. Then they may not be incentivized to create that, and then we wouldn't have these great drugs that, you know, I would actually much prefer the private sector be creating than have some sort of state doing that in its inefficient way that it may do things, right? So private businesses would be much more incentivized to do it more efficiently and effectively. So giving them those incentives makes sense.
That argument really got me because it's true, right? It's so much easier.
Those are the best type of arguments, Tyus.
Well, it's so much harder to create something new than it would be for a competing company to go and take the pill apart and go, oh, this is the active ingredient. We can just remake that, right?
Right.
So a couple of things that came to mind, only because I've gotten months to think about the argument, is one, the cost of creating that stuff is often so ridiculously high because of the regulations put in place. And so that's one potential factor in that slows that creation. So they have to protect their asset because we've put in so many hurdles for them to get through to create it.
Yeah, but I think that's sort of the tail wagging the dog, right? Because the huge chunk of the resources is in the, you know, hiring all these scientists to do the, and I'm just talking about the pharmaceutical example now, hiring all these scientists to do all these tests and figure these things out and be really smart, and, you know, create and invent. And then, yes, I think the costs are significantly increased because then they have a lot of government intervention dealing with, you know, getting regulations and passing the right number of tests and all that. Different issue, though, right? And that's the most we'd talk about later on, even though I think we're probably in relative agreement about that. It'd be a pretty boring discussion because we still need to agree with each other. I'd say yes, agreed.
Yeah.
But I think you're really talking about a relatively small portion of the investment, even though it's not insignificant, right? Because, you know, look, so they have to pass FDA testing. It's going to cost them, you know, millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars just to do the right testing and put the right scientists in place, do the right, you know, do it a statistically significant sample size, et cetera, et cetera. So it does add to the cost, but that's not the significant cost. I think the biggest cost is really in the invention itself, unrelated to any sort of regulation.
So let's create a hypothetical world where, in this hypothetical, we don't have that government sitting there, right? We don't have a copyright system or a
no government
patent
at all.
System or anything like that, right? But we're a pharmaceutical company, and let's say we've come up with a great drug, but it has cost us a lot of money to do.
Tyus and Jason Pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
Okay.
Perfect. Yeah. We came up with Viagra, and we're like, man, people would really love this, but if we put this out there, other people could dissect it, take it apart, and go like, oh, that's how it works. So what would be a way that we could protect it without needing that entity there? So like the first thing that comes to mind for me, just to throw something out there, would be what would it look like if you wanted to purchase this, you had to sign a voluntary agreement saying that you were going to use it only for your own personal use, not for, not to replicate or anything like that. And then if somebody were to do that, we know they violated
our copyright and we could go after them, or not our copyright, our agreement, and we could pursue them, or, you know, seek damages.
Sure. And you'd say you'd seek damages with the state?
No. Against them, because they essentially aggressed against us by stealing from us because we only sold it with the agreement that they could not replicate it.
All right, so...
I don't know. That's off the top of my head.
Well, I don't like that hypothetical in because one of the bases of the hypothetical, I think, is flawed. Because you said that the Jason Tyus pharmaceutical company had created Viagra. We wouldn't do that. Or we may not do that, right? I mean, we wouldn't spend the millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars. Now it would be cheaper without a state telling us.
Let's go with the polio vaccine.
Huh?
Let's go with polio vaccine.
Polio vaccine, okay. So the question is, would we have developed it, right?
I mean, unlikely that I would have.
Okay, but
I'm not smart enough for that.
Well, or you're not. I don't think it's a question of smarts. It's a question of incentives, right? You are smart enough to hire smart scientists who've studied science and, you know, biology, immunology, whatever
it needs to be. Well, I mean, like, vaccines were kind of discovered by accident. So was penicillin. So, I mean, let's say we stumbled upon something. I'm not saying it has to be any of those.
But all right, so something we stumbled upon, and then we decide, hey, how do we want to distribute this, right? So that's different, right? Because we're not talking about incentives, right? Because in theory, the IP system is there to incentivize, you know, the patent system anyway, is there to incentivize creation, right? So there, the patent didn't incentivize to do it. So again, the hypothetical is flawed in that.
I see.
You know, it doesn't have the same type of people don't have the same reasons for doing things, right?
Okay.
So
I understand. So let's change the hypothetical and say that we do invest a bunch of money because
we think we can contractually if we strike the gold, we can contractually get people to only use it for the purposes we want to and not reverse engineer.
My father, true story, my father has Alzheimer's right now, right? God, I can't even say it. Even to this day, I can't say that and be confident that I'm pronouncing the word correctly. So he legitimately has that. I have a vested interest in that being fixed, solved, resolved, cured. And I mean, wouldn't that level of incentive of there's so many people out there that have this need, including myself, that I might want to invest that money?
Maybe. I mean, it depends on how much money you have, right? If you had a limited resource of, call it $1 million, right? And you say, okay, I could just spend $1 million going to dinners and paying my mortgage or whatever it is, or for my car or gas or whatever it is, and doing things to that. Or I could spend that $1 million to invest in this research for my dad's health. Is basically what you'd be paying for. You'd have that choice, right? I mean, I don't know what the answer is, right? Different people would have different varying levels of where they split the resources.
But let's say we did though, and we came up with a solution, but then we went, okay, I've proven this cures this disease, but how would I protect it without a copyright patent system in place?
So I guess you could do it contractually. Very inefficient as far as enforcement, though, right? Compared to the way we have it now. I mean, I hate to say the government was being efficient when they set this copyright patent system, but okay. compared to the system that you just posited, I think it's a more efficient system.
Okay.
Because like in the patents, specifically not copyrights, but patents, it's a strict liability offense, right? So it would constitute, you know, if it's being used and you could show it used everything that's in the patent claim, then the company's liable. So other companies that could also do the production distribution of it would not do it, knowing that they could be liable under the current system. Whereas if they think, oh well, I never made a deal with this guy, some, you know, Joe Blow took it from, he signed a deal, he's
judgment proof,
he gave it to me, good luck, right? So then I think,
so it'd be the same situation if like I wrote a book and in buying that book you agree to never copy it, but then if you gave it to somebody else, they're like, we didn't sign the agreement.
That's right,
we could copy it.
Right, now you could also sign an agreement that says I agree to copy this, and anytime I transfer it, I agree that any transferee will be bound by the same terms as I am, and so forth, you know, ad nauseum, right? So you could do that, but
much harder to enforce.
Yeah, much more difficult to enforce. Very, very inefficient to enforce that, you know, without the sort of system that's in place. And, you know, IP really started, you know, in, I think it's early 1800s, the Statute of Anne. In England, which was the first copyright statute. And they decided, hey, we need to have some sort of incentives for people to start creating more and more.
you know, before printing press was around.
What is the statute of Anne?
It's the first ever Copyright Act in the world.
That's just the name of it.
That's the name of it. It was the name of it in England, yeah.
Oh, what were they trying to copyright or protect? Or, sorry,
I don't know. Get a little
history lesson here.
I don't know.
Okay, fair enough.
But I'm sure we could Google Wikipedia, find it pretty easily. If only we had a network of computers accessible to us, that would have all the...
just a huge array of screens that could help us.
Yes.
So let's switch gears a little bit.
Okay.
And I want to talk a little bit about this term that gets me in trouble on the internet, where I talk about pulling yourself up from your bootstraps.
I love that term.
Yeah, somebody called me out on it and was like, well, you know, that's physically impossible. Like, and I was like, well, that doesn't change the meaning of it. Like, just the fact that it's, you know, you can't do it doesn't mean that that the meaning couldn't be done. And so, anyways, I love it. I think it's very, very empowering to think that we're all in charge of our own destiny. And I'd love to hear kind of your interpretation of what that looks like. I know you've got kind of a heroic story around some of that, but we don't have to go too deep into any of that. What do you think is preventing people from being able to fulfill that metaphor of pulling themselves up from their own bootstraps?
Wow, that's a really loaded question. I mean, there's so much involved. We could do 40 hours, 50, 800 hours on that exact issue.
Buckle up, everybody.
get ready. What's stopping people from being able to pull those jobs? To a large extent, I think it's themselves. Now, some people have, you know, actual mental limitations that won't let them do that, right? So, both in terms of there's like, you know, mental disabilities, you know, disabilities where they have those matters. But as far as able-bodied people, there's also certain people were born with better processors than others, right? I mean, an IQ is a quantitative, say what you want about whether it's good or bad or how much, you know, how
accurate
accurate it is. But, you know, it's a quantitative feature, right? So somebody who has, you know, I'll call it like a Forrest Gump level IQ, which is just barely above, you know, being disabled, but is, you know, so you're an able person, they're not going to be programming, you know, the next Facebook, right? Or the next big company that's going to be out there to do it. So you have that extent too, right? But for anyone who has, like, you know, at least average or above average IQ, or even a little slightly below average, that has a processor that can actually work and compute, you know, regular, you know, A plus B equals C, I think what holds them back is either their societal pressures, either external pressures from society or internal in themselves, that either they don't think they can do it, or they don't have the... they don't have the, for lack of a better word, they don't want to sacrifice to do it, right? They don't have the, I don't want to say intestinal.
They won't pay the cost.
They won't pay the cost to do it. So
what are some of those costs that people have a hard time breaking through as far as barriers are concerned?
Sure. So like when it comes, a very simple one, which kind of is the heart of it all, is money, right? There's finances, resources. A lot of times people are not being what I would consider smart with their resources, right? They're not maximizing the utility that they could get with their resources.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. So if you're making, you know, I think one of the best quotes I ever heard, and I wish I knew who I could attribute this to, but I heard it a long, long time ago. They said, if you have a landlord and a Land Rover, your priorities are messed up.
I love that. That's a great quote.
Yeah. I don't remember who.
Is there any copyright issue with us using that quote?
I think we're okay with that.
All right.
It's de minimis use.
De minimis. De minimis, so, Maximus Aurelius, my favorite gladiator.
I think it would be considered fair use. But, you know, it's exemplary of the point, right? So the perfect example of that is, you know, yeah, if you're making, you know, $3,000 a month and yet you have a brand new Gucci purse and a new car that you're spending $1,000 a month on and da-da-da-da-da, and of your $3,000 a month you're making, you know, you're spending $3,500, right? So that's... not sacrificing appropriately.
So priorities.
Right, priorities, right.
So it's setting the priorities as far as where you put your money, right?
Or your resources generally, not specifically money, but I mean, it's time as well and other things. Some people would rather sleep than work, right?
Yeah.
They'd rather be more comfortable and hang out at home than, you know, or they want to have a job where they can just sit around and do nothing and get, you know, paid $7 an hour versus work really hard and, you know, make 15 or 20 or whatever. I mean, I don't want to talk about absolute dollar amounts because I'm not a fan of, you know, any sort of minimum wage or anything like that. But, you know, less versus more, right?
Yeah. So there's so many people that are trapped in the 9-to-5 job. They can't get through that. They can't break through that. And you kind of had a quote about investing that you you gave to me. And who told it to you? You have to invest 3 times?
My grandfather. So, you know, my grandfather, Charlie Letterman, I have to give him
a shout out.
No, no problem. No, this is good. I love sharing this because my grandfather shared it with me, and I wish more people learned this. So, you know, my grandfather, who did, you know, decently well for himself, retired at the age of 45 as a photographer, and then invested in the stock market and, you know, lived the rest of his years pretty comfortably. He said to me, he said, you know, I remember this when I was maybe 6-7 years old. He told me, he said, Jason, and this is probably one of the best nuggets I've ever received from him and that I've ever gotten in my whole life from anyone. He said, you know, the reason that rich people are rich is they have to earn money 3 times. So you earn money one, the traditional way, which most people can do. You know, it's, you know, you go work your 9-to-5 or you work as an entrepreneur, whatever it is. You make money for your services or goods that you produce. So that's, everyone knows that one, right?
You trade your time for money.
Trade your time for money. In whatever, you know, whatever way you do that, right? So that one, pretty much everyone knows that one, right? That's number one. Number two is a little trickier, and it kind of goes back to what we just talked about, which is save your money, right? So once you make it, you have to be able to save it. Like if you made $3,000 in a month, or you made $300,000 in a month, if you spent it all, if you spent $300,000 a month, you're in the same exact position as the guy who made $3,000 a month and spent his $3,000 a month, right? You're in a worse position than the guy who made $3,000 a month and only spent $2,000, right?
I've heard this referred to as like the bathtub analogy, where they talk about everyone's just focusing on trying to get more water out of the spigot, and at a certain point it maxes out, and you got to just plug the drain.
Yeah,
right. Like,
that's right.
That's the way to fill the tub.
Yeah. So that's the second one, and I think that's what trips up most people. And you know, these are sort of the three things to do to get rich, so to say, or to have a lot of resources. So number two is like I said, is saving the money. And number three, which if you got past number two, you're already in the, you know, very small minority of people. Number three is to invest it so that the money is making money for you, right? So you're not trading your time for money. I'll call it passive income or whatever method, you know, however you want to call it. It could be investment in your own business, whatever, so it's not really passive. But you invest the money so it has a good return on the investment, so that that money that you saved in step two is actually making you money in step three. So it's those three things. I don't call them steps. Each one, you need to actually make money 3 different times, right? So most people, and it's not easy, right? So that's why most people don't do it, right? But it's a pretty simple, relatively simple formula if you think about it.
I mean, we could get into each detail in.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the third one is really, at least for me, the third one's really hard and daunting to even consider. Like the idea of, like, you know, work your butt off. I totally get that. I'm comfortable with that. The idea of live on.
Within your means? Under your means even?
Yeah, under your means so that you've got an excess. That makes total sense to me. And, you know, the way you do that is you reduce your expenses, pay off your debts so that you don't have to deal with those anymore. But then that third one of make your money work for you is really challenging. And the only area I've ever, stocks and real estate are the only two areas that I've ever had any success with that. But I know there's people that have tons of different ways,
sure,
of doing it. It blows my mind how clever people are.
Yeah, but you know, if you don't have all three of those things, then you can't really win, right? You can't really win it, you know. Because I mean, let's say you didn't have number three is making you money, but if you're still spending it all, if you're not doing number two, then it's not getting there. But you're right. I think three may be the most daunting, only because that's the least familiar to a lot of people. So, by the way, two I think is very daunting as well, because in a lot of cultures, that's just not part of their culture, right?
Yeah.
And similarly, one, right? In some cultures, they're not interested in working hard, right?
Well, I've been in debt. I've been buried by debt before, and I remember being at the bottom of that and kind of looking at this mountain of stress on top of me, and people saying, "Oh, you just, you know, pay off one thing at a time and then roll it into the next." And that's a real easy sentence to say, but when you're facing it, it's a whole different daunting idea.
Definitely much easier said than done.
Yeah. And like, I know you make what I consider very courageous moves on a fairly regular basis. and I'm always looking at it just like, that man, that would scare the heck out of me. But it was, you know, that's the right move. That's the right thing. And maybe that's the whole, your skill set of kind of removing the emotion and just going, this is a logical decision that I'm going to be going after here.
Yeah, I think that is. And you know, that's, you know, we sort of started this conversation asking, you know, you asked me, why don't a lot of people pick themselves by the bootstraps? And one thing I said was they don't have the processor to do it, but also a lot of people just don't have a skill set to do all three of those things that would cause you to get wealthy. Or even, I mean, look, the thing is, you don't need to do all three of those to pick yourself up by the bootstraps, right? I mean, if you did, if you at least did one of them really well, you'd be out of what I consider poverty level, you know? So, and you could have sort of picked yourself up by those bootstraps.
Well, hey, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on, sharing your insights, giving us your grandfather's like wealth formula. Appreciate it so much. I'm officially calling you our legal correspondent.
Okay, there you go. Perfect.
And feel free to come back anytime you want.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Thanks cool. for having me.
If you want to know more, learn more, get involved, you can reach out to us. You can hit us up at, if you email us at podcast@lpnevada.com or go to lpnevada.com where you'll see all of the social events and everything that we've got going on there. We would love your involvement, so please don't hesitate. As we try and get this movement going a little bit faster and having a little bit more momentum. Until next time, make it all about freedom.
This show is brought to you by the Libertarian Party of Nevada. Music is provided by T. Sims. Please support the show by subscribing, sharing it with friends, and leaving a positive review on iTunes. For more information or to learn how to get involved, visit lpnevada.org. Thank you for listening.